A few years back, my friend Justin Warner from Food Network moved out to South Dakota. He opened a ramen joint, and he is always posting pictures of all the great food he's not only cooking, but eating all over South Dakota. He's always telling me to come visit. And you know, one of the best ways to experience a new place is to eat your way through it. But it's equally important to live your way through it, too. And when you summer in South Dakota, you can fill up on all the lake days, hikes, rides, and small-town strolls that'll leave you with a regained sense of wonder and a hunger to do it all over again. See why there's so much South Dakota, so little time at TravelSouthDakota.com. This episode contains explicit language. This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people, and we're coming to you live from Caveat in New York City. Way back in June 2018, I organized a live event in New York called the Bucatini Dialogues, a debate about pasta shapes. Now, this might sound familiar to you. This was where I kicked off Mission Impossible, my quest to invent a new pasta shape, actually get it made, and actually sell it. We even played a little bit of the tape from this live event in the first episode of Mission Impossible, but most of it has never seen the light of day. Until now. Joining me on stage that night were Francis Lamb and Evan Kleinman, who, unlike me, are both trained chefs. Francis hosts the Splendid Table podcast and radio show and is the editor-in-chief at Clarkson Potter, the cookbook publisher. Evan hosts Good Food on KCRW in Los Angeles, and she owned one of LA's top Italian restaurants for more than 25 years. Of course, she was also my pasta spiritual advisor during Mission Impossible. Now, the idea for the live event was inspired by something Francis tweeted about how he hates Bucatini. You'll hear more about that, but that tweet got me thinking, let's explore lots of existing pasta shapes and debate their merits. I can lay out the three criteria that I would use to judge my pasta shape. You all know it by now. Forkability, how well the shape stays on your fork. Sauceability, how well it holds sauce. And of course, where would we be without tooth sinkability, how satisfying it is to sink your teeth into it. We could cover everything from spaghettoni, which is an extra thick spaghetti, to wagon wheels, discuss how they're used, what they go with, and which one should go straight to the garbage. And the truth is, we didn't talk much about other shapes in our original pasta series, so I am very excited to share this with you now. Okay, let's travel back to June 2018 to Caveat, a basement club on New York's Lower East Side. I want to allow our listeners to get to know you guys a little bit more and to understand your particular connections to pasta. Evan, tell me about a particular formative pasta dish in your life.
I would say it was when I was in my early 20s, maybe barely 20, and I was lucky. I was on my third trip to Italy, and I was hanging out with some friends in San Remo, and I was on the beach, and I got hungry, and I was with a friend of mine who's Italian, and he said, oh, let's go get something to eat. And so I'm looking for the frozen banana stand, being from Los Angeles. and he said, no, let's go have a nice plate of spaghetti alla vongole. And I'm like, they have that here at the beach? And so we go up to a thatched roof restaurant where everybody's sitting in the restaurant in their bathing suits. And I was served this bowl of linguine alle vongole, which is linguine with clams, with garlic, wine, parsley, lemon juice. And that was just it for me.
And what do you mean? Like, why was that so significant?
It blew my mind. Well, the whole experience was this coming together of high food craft that was obviously geared to a culture, attached to a culture, embedded in the sensuality of summer in Italy at the beach. So it was like a seamless whole, a beautiful little bubble that crashed over my, Los Angeles, raised in the 60s. Not anything like that at all.
How is your life different today because of that bowl of pasta?
I went home and I had to figure out how to make it. And I started traveling to Europe and tasting things and then coming home and wanted to reproduce them. It sort of put me in a different place, a different level of obsession, and also an understanding of where my heart really lay, even though I went on to get a BA in Italian literature and film and an MBA. Yeah. And then I ended up having a restaurant, right?
A short dalliance with the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Did you put that MBA to good use?
Oh, well, my restaurant's closed.
Francis, tell us about a formative pasta dish in your life.
You know what's crazy is my answer is also linguine alla vongole.
I love this so much.
Wow.
You know, I grew up the child of Chinese immigrants in suburban New Jersey. And one cheer for suburban New Jersey. Exactly. Woo! One whoop. I grew up, you know, one of two Asian kids in my elementary school. I always felt weird. I always felt different. I didn't really belong. And then my parents worked in Chinatown here in New York City, which is the neighborhood right over from Little Italy. And I would come out to their work. Like, we didn't have...
childcare?
Yes. Or things to do as a child. So, like, when it was summertime, like, what are you going to do today? Mommy, can I come to work with you? And literally sit in your workplace for 10 straight hours and not do any goddamn thing. Yeah, well, that sounds great. I'm going to do that. But the highlight was that we would go out to lunch and sometimes we would go to Little Italy. And when we went to Little Italy, we would some if like we were feeling high on the hog, we would go to a place called Il Cortile, which means the courtyard. And there was this beautiful courtyard. You know, for a Little Italy restaurant, it was like really quite beautiful. And there was an indoor courtyard and a skylight, and it felt like you were in some al fresco place. I didn't know those words. I'd never been to Italy. I'd never seen pictures of Italy, but felt like I was somewhere else. And the food came out, and my parents would, you know, order for me. And we got linguine alla vongole every single time. Because it was noodles and seafood, which is food we understood as Chinese people, but white people ate it. So when I would eat linguine alla vongole, or as my mom called it, linguine with white clam sauce, I felt like maybe I can belong.
And how did those experiences eating in that restaurant, how is your life different today because of those experiences?
I became a white person. It's great. You can see the stuff I can do now.
Yeah. Now, at this special event, we weren't only there to share happy memories of the pasta of our youth. The whole point of the evening was to debate pasta shapes, to argue. Like I said, the idea for this event came from something Francis had tweeted about how much he hates bucatini. Bucatini, in case you need a reminder, is like a thick spaghetti but hollow down the center. So it's almost like a narrow drinking straw. And why does Francis hate it?
Have you ever tried to use a drinking straw?
You can't.
Have you ever tried to suck the drinking straw into your mouth? It is physically impossible. Because it's not solid. And there's a goddamn hole in the middle, which everyone's like, that's the beauty of bucatini. You get sauce in the middle. Fuck bucatini and the sauce in the middle. You can't get the goddamn thing in your mouth.
So Francis says you can't slurp bucatini because it's hollow. But Evan was not going to let Francis have the last word.
This is what I love about bucatini is you will go to restaurants in Rome and you will see men, businessmen, wearing beautiful white starched shirts, order a plate of bucatini alla matriciana, which is like a lot
perfect
of...
perfect in every way except for...
a lot of oil, a lot of tomatoes. So there's a very high percentage that you will get that on your body, which for an Italian man is like not a good thing. And you see them take their ties and flip them over their shoulder and hunch over that bowl and carefully twirl, not like a child's spaghetti fork filled with pasta, but like a couple noodles. And then delicately, for a man, put it in their mouths and chew. Nobody is trying to slurp it up because everybody knows you can't suck up a straw.
I don't see why this is my problem.
Why do you think that slurping is your preferred technique of eating a long noodle?
That feeling, like, look, you're inhaling the pasta, right? In this, like, almost literal way. You're taking it in. You're one with the world. How many breathing exercises have you done today?
None.
You're taking in from, you're taking what the earth is giving you. you're feeling oneness and gratitude.
Oh.
And you can do that while getting pasta in your mouth at the same time.
Well, but another argument for slurping, Francis, might be that with noodle soups, let's say with Asian noodle soups, one of the advantages of slurping is that it creates a sort of virtuous cycle of airflow. You know, a lot of people think you smell with the front of your nose when you taste, but actually the smell that you mostly taste with isn't the back of your throat. It's the aromas going up the back of your throat into your nose, which is why slurping soup makes it taste better. So I wonder if the fact that you can't slurp bucatini is a problem for that reason. It doesn't have that Asian noodle soup advantage. Evan, how do you respond?
Well, I do find it fascinating. I just started thinking about it as we're talking, that most Asian noodles are long noodles for the most part.
For the most part, yeah.
For the most part. There's no wagon wheels. There's no quills. There's no fusilli, which I think is the stupidest shape ever. Ooh. Yeah. So if you grow up, you grew up starting with noodles? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
In broths, mm-hmm. often?
Often, yeah.
So I would understand that you have a slurping constitution.
Do you think there's some merit to that idea, Francis?
I think it's probably valid. I think certainly for like my psychological, like,
the comfort things.
Yeah, I think it is true that most noodles I grew up with are slurpy-type noodles.
If there's another shape that can be just as tooth-sinkable as bucatini that will be more forkable, then it's better than bucatini.
Spaghettoni.
Okay, so then...
But it's not better. It's just another shape. I mean, it's like, if you look at the dictionary, the vocabulario, if you will...
Now you're just making up words.
I don't believe that one for a second.
Of Italian pasta shapes... It's just this incredible expression of human ingenuity with the simplest ingredients possible and fantasy, just playing. So sometimes there are really, really fun shapes that have excellent forkability, but you don't necessarily want to eat them all the time, like wagon wheels. Wagon wheels, for most of us, we haven't had them as adults, but every once in a while I have them. And I'm like, wow, this is such a great shape. Why don't I eat this more often? But then I just don't.
Like most traditional pasta shapes have a traditional sauce that they're paired with, right? Because mm-hmm. they were regional and like, mm-hmm. you know, this was the sauce of our mm-hmm. region, da da da. Mm-hmm. What's the traditional way to eat wagon wheels?
Well, either in broth or with a creamy ragu. So when it's in the bowl, you see the little bits of browned meat, mm-hmm. like the separated pieces of meat that are held together with the sauce. They like cling to the insides of the spokes. And it's just really fun to eat.
Is the wagon wheel like a legit old school shape?
Yeah. It's called rotelle. It's an actual Italian shape.
And what is the wagon? Like it's hard for me to get behind the wagon wheel.
Sorry.
I mean.
What's your problem with
so
the wagon wheel?
What do you
wheel?
Like? What
doesn't
do you
it
like?
Turn mushy?
Do you have macaroni and cheese al dente?
When I can.
That's weird.
Why would you ever turn down tooth sinkability when you can have it, Evan?
Well, it's just a different kind of food. Even within Italy, the way people like their pasta cooked varies region to region.
In some of the research we've done on this workful, you know, sensory scientists say that research shows that we like dynamic contrast in bites. We like bites that have multiple textures together in the same bite.
Sure.
One of the problems with a lot of symmetrical pastas is even if it's cooked just right, it might be the perfect tooth sinkability, but every bite will be the same.
Sure.
That's why I think maybe there's not enough asymmetrical pastas out there. What do you guys think?
I think that's interesting. Most of the pastas I find myself eating are definitely symmetrical. But I do love eating things in which every bite is slightly different. Give me an example of an industrial shape, like elicoidi. Have you ever seen those? They're like a more modern shape. They look like radiatori, like radiators.
Right.
Yeah.
That is a great shape, though, because that is really, I think, the pinnacle of sauceability. Of all shapes is radiatore. No shape is more sauceable than radiatore.
Well, some people would say that about fusilli, which I also think is its downfall, but that's a whole other conversation.
Wait, but it doesn't have enough body to stand up to the sauce. I want to return to a question about sauceability, in particular ridges. Evan, you said, and I agree, that anytime you can have ridges around the outside of your pasta, you want that because it increases surface area and increases sauce adhesion. Is there ever a time when you would want plain penne over penne rigate, which is ridged penne? Francis, what do you think?
Let me back up a little bit and talk about your three criteria. I think they sound valid, but I think they don't actually encapsulate the universe of pleasure that pasta and noodles can exist in, right? I think the suggestion is that there's like an ultimate form, and that ultimate form produces the most pleasure. But I think if we open our minds a little bit, still hate bucatini. We can accept that there are lots of different ways for a pasta to be pleasurable. And if you're asking me about smooth penne versus ridged penne, yeah, the smooth is never going to have the same kind of like, you know, sauceability, right? But what if what you want in that moment was really to eat the pasta and the sauce was just helping the pasta along rather than the other way around? And I think of like a really beautiful like pappardelle, right? A really beautiful fresh pappardelle. So often when it's like made well, I really just want to eat the pasta and I want to feel the texture of the pasta. I want to sometimes
that's the wide flat one for folks.
And sometimes they're like, you know, about an inch wide.
Sometimes they're even wider.
Yeah, then they're like kind of hard to eat. Then it's like eating a rug. I don't want to do that. It's like, oh, it's a long rug. That's delicious.
I'm not suggesting that there is only one shape that's better than all the others. I agree that different shapes have different strengths and weaknesses, but I also think that, like, in the entire universe of shapes, some are better than others, demonstrably better than others. They're not all equal. It's not like every shape has a place. Like, there's...
No, literally, every shape has a place.
When would you eat penne over penne rigate?
Well, penne lisci, which is the penne that doesn't have the ridges, and is sometimes called mostaccioli, or also ziti, is often used in like baked pasta dishes that aren't lasagna. You take your penne that don't have ridges, you cook them, you put them in cold water, then you add your sauce, your cheese, your whatever else you want, you pack it into your baking dish, cover it with Parmesan, you put it in the oven. And then, for some reason, the lisci stays more, it has more form, precisely because it hasn't absorbed as much sauce as the rigate. Ooh. What do you say that, Mr. Pasta Engineer Man?
I would say that's a good point. I will take that under advisement.
For those of you at home, you can't see Dan's guts falling all over the floor from that complete evisceration. Oh my God.
Coming up, if you thought we were done talking about slurping, you were wrong. We go deep on the best approach to eating Asian noodle soups and take questions from the audience. Plus, I'll have a Cascatelli shipping update. Stick around.
Now, a delicious word from our sponsors.
Norwegian Cruise Line breaks the boundaries of global cruise travel. When you cruise with NCL, you're going to get award-winning specialty restaurants, a variety of food and beverage offerings, immersive entertainment, and the most thrilling experiences at sea. It is first class. These ships have all kinds of specialty restaurants, Brazilian steakhouse, French, Spanish, Italian, Japanese, Mexican. Select ships also feature al fresco dining on the waterfront and Ocean Boulevard, an oceanside promenade lined with bars and restaurants. Norwegian provides guests with truly authentic and fresh dining and bar experiences complemented by exceptional service. Almost everything you'll eat is prepared from scratch by highly experienced chefs. And they got whatever you're going to be in the mood for. You want a quick, casual family meal? They've got that. You want a beautiful four-course feast? They've got that too. And you can sip something delicious at one of up to 23 unique bar and lounge options per ship. Visit and explore exciting destinations around the world and enjoy unique experiences on board. With no set dining and entertainment times and no formal dress codes, you have the flexibility to design your ideal vacation. Book your next adventure at ncl.com. Whether you're a family vacation traveler, a business tripper, or a long weekend adventurer, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. They've got over 7,000 locations and 22 brands, including Comfort Hotels, Radisson Hotels, and Cambria Hotels, and you will get the best value for your money when you book with Choice Hotels. I especially love those Cambria hotels. They have locally inspired hotel bars with all kinds of specialty cocktails, downtown locations right in the center of all the action. Radisson hotels have flexible workspaces. That way, if you're a business traveler, you'll be able to get all your work done. On-site restaurants, fantastic. And then at Comfort Hotels, you'll enjoy free hot breakfast with fresh waffles and great pools for the whole family and spacious rooms. I mean, if you have kids, you understand the importance of the pool. If you stay at a hotel with a pool, almost nothing else matters. Fortunately, all the Choice Hotels take care of all the other stuff too, but I mean, a pool is a great start. Whatever kind of vacation you're going on, whatever kind of travel you're doing, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Book direct at choicehotels.com. Where travels come true. This episode is brought to you by Merrick Pet Care. We have a dog. Her name is Sasha. She's almost four. She's a standard poodle. She's black and fluffy and soft and very adorable. And when we first got her, we took her to like this puppy kindergarten training class. The whole family went. And, you know, they're teaching how to use the treats and all this. The trainer watched Sasha for a bit and said, she's very food motivated. And my daughter Emily turned to me and said, she's a Pashman. And so she is food motivated, and that's why we make a point of feeding Sasha high-quality pet food. Founded in Hereford, Texas, Merrick has been crafting high-quality dog food for over 30 years. Real is Merrick's recipe, so they always use deboned meat, fish, or poultry as the number one ingredient. And let me tell you something. When it's dinner time, Sasha is motivated, okay? She is highly motivated to come in from patrolling the backyard at dinner, to get up off the couch, whatever she's doing, she will drop it and come running. Check out Merrick online or in your local pet store and look for their new packaging with real ingredients shown on the bag and inside it. At Boar's Head, delicious is in the details. And you see that in their incredible selection of hummus flavors. Boar's Head hummus is expertly crafted to achieve the perfect balance of creamy texture and refined taste. You can taste those chickpeas. You can taste the tahini. You can taste a little bit of acidity. It's got it all. I especially love their roasted red pepper hummus made with fire-roasted peppers. You can even taste a little bit of that char. It's perfectly dippable. It's perfectly spreadable. This is the kind of thing you always want to have on hand in your refrigerator. Dip, scoop, spread, or smear Boar's Head hummus to your heart's content. Hummus so extraordinary, it can only be Boar's Head. Compromise elsewhere. Welcome back to The Sporkful. I'm Dan Pashman, and I have a Cascatelli shipping update. As of now, all orders placed through May and about 75% of orders placed in June have shipped. But variety packs that include other Sfollini products, those are packed by hand, so they're a few weeks behind. The folks at Sfollini are working their butts off to catch up. And I gotta tell you, I saw a new box just recently, and Steve at Sfollini has the Cascatelli so dialed in. It's even more beautiful than it was at the beginning. I mean, the ruffles are more uniform. The whole thing just looks gorgeous. Now, look, I know it's still a long way to get the pasta, but don't let that stop you. Just order some now. You'll forget you ordered it. Then it'll show up at your doorstep in a couple months, and you'll be so, so happy. In other words, keep the orders coming. As always, you can place your order at Sfollini.com. That's Sfogli.com. All right, let's get back to our live event about pasta shapes. In both Italian pasta and in Asian noodles, there's a lot of tradition, a lot of beautiful tradition. But I do wonder if sometimes certain traditions can be a barrier to progress, to change and new ideas.
Gentrifying the pasta conversation.
Well, for instance, here's one rule that I've heard that I don't understand. When the pasta comes to me and it's been served to me, and if it's pappardelle or some other shape that's especially large or long and it's lacking in forkability, why is it so wrong for me to cut it? Well, how do you eat pappardelle when it's each one is 3 inches wide and 2 feet long?
I'd cut it and feel shame.
Here's the question. Is biting it before?
No, but you can bite it. Yeah.
So why is that different? If you bite it in half, it falls back into the plate. That was the same thing
bad.
As cutting it.
You cannot fall back in the plate. You know, you have to eat it correctly, and it has to be beautiful as you're doing it, you know.
I want to hear from each of you. What's one pasta or noodle tradition that you feel should be discarded?
Angel hair pasta in a bowl with no broth with tomato sauce. Thank you. Thank you.
Why?
Because angel hair pasta was never meant to be a pasta asciutta, dry, a pasta served dry just with sauce. It's meant to be in a broth.
Really?
Yeah, the 80s notwithstanding.
Yeah, really? That's amazing. You're telling me vermicelli was meant to be like pho.
Well, angel hair, yeah. Vermicelli, sometimes some places call spaghetti vermicelli, but yes, very, very thin, fine noodles is meant to be in a broth, yes.
This is blowing my mind, because if you walk into an Asian grocery and you go into the noodle aisle,
which is unbelievable,
and there are so many shapes.
So many.
And you know, and obviously not some flour, some rice, some mung beans.
And that's soup, the whatever. Interesting thing about Asian noodles is that the actual dough, it has so much variability.
Right. And it changes, like it's really different textures and subtle ways that maybe are inarticulable. But they're, like when they have an English label, 75% of them are called vermicelli for no discernible reason. But now I'm realizing that most of those noodles are meant to be served in broth. So maybe someone somewhere along the line was like, that's like a, you know, an Italian pasta that they serve in broth. My head is blowing up right now. Because I never knew why like rice sticks were called vermicelli and why they were all called vermicelli.
Right. So we talked a lot about strategies for eating pastas that are difficult to get on the fork, difficult to keep on the fork, difficult to not get messy. Let's talk briefly about strategies for Asian noodle soups.
I'm such a bad slurper.
You mean like you do it, but you don't do it well?
No, I don't. I don't do it efficiently, and I'm constantly biting it, and parts are falling back in the bowl, which it makes me feel ashamed.
Don't feel shame. We don't have rules that oppress people like that. You can cut the noodles if you want. Whatever. Do your thing, girl. No, seriousness.
Tell us about your approach.
I don't have like a...
He learned too early to know what the approach is.
Yeah,
it's
so intuitive.
Didn't you tell me you have some kind of system where you take the noodles and rest them up on top of a lily pad?
Only for ramen? For okay. Whatever reason, I do this for ramen.
Okay.
You have a lily pad?
I bring a lily pad with me. Yeah. So the lily pad thing is when I'm eating ramen, I don't know exactly why I do this only for ramen, but I have it like sort of pounded in my head that the noodles in ramen should be protected. And so I protect them by, you know, you get the big steaming bowl. And the first thing I do, usually there's like a slice or two of like, you know, pork belly or something, you know, some kind of meaty garnish that's usually a nice flat thing. So it takes up like a fair amount of surface area in the bowl. And so what I do is I go in and I, with my chopsticks, and I take the entire tangle of noodles and I lift them up out of the bowl for just a second, just enough for it to like lose a few degrees of heat. And then I sort of gently rest them back on top of the bowl and hopefully most of them will catch onto like the pork and like it'll sort of rest and it'll sit outside of the soup. So I can then eat the noodles and eat the soup without having to worry about the noodles sitting in the hot soup and absorbing more of that broth and getting softer.
Wow.
It's a
That's
sweet
impressive.
Move.
So
we can do this.
It's just about time for us to go to the town hall portion of this debate. But before we do, I want to hear quickly from each of you. Bucatini aside, give me one shape that you feel like should just be eliminated from the canon and one shape that you think is very underrated that requires more attention.
Fusilli.
That's the corkscrew, should be thrown in
Bye.
The garbage.
See
no,
Vasily.
All right.
Go on.
And Evan, what shape do you wish to elevate? Do you want more people to know about?
Candele.
Which one's that?
Oh. Candele are from Liguria, and they're usually made of egg pasta. They're like candles. They're very, very long, and they have a hole in the middle, but it's a really big hole, and the walls are really thin. So when you cook them, they collapse on themselves, and you're not supposed to cut them. But they're just so weird and wonderful, and they look gorgeous in a bowl, the tangle of them, and you can just serve somebody one candle. They're just fun.
How long is a typical candle? Oh, like over like a foot long. It's like a scroll almost.
Yeah.
Right. Francis, one shape you would get rid of, one shape you would elevate.
All pasta shapes are wonderful except for one.
What about Pac-Man shapes?
Oh, dude. Are you any of you, does anyone remember the Chef Boyardee, like pasta in a can, right? Like, did you ever remember when they had a Pac-Man version of them? People remember
yeah.
this?
Yeah.
Okay, so I was you know, yay big. I loved any form of, you know, Western food. And, you know, so like, pasta in a can was totally, like, kind of my vibe. And when Pac-Man came out, forget it, because I, like, love Pac-Man. I'm like, oh, my God, Pac-Man food, oh! And it was, like, and, like, the little meatballs were, like, the little, like Pac-Man was eating the little meatballs. And so I had, like, these, like, weird, like, industrial food meatballs that were, like, not God's plan. And so I loved that stuff. And one day I was home sick from school, and as a way to cheer me up, my mom made the Pac-Man Chef Boyardee for me with the meatballs, and I ate it. But remember, I was sick. That pleasure was robbed from me.
That is not good.
Forever.
That is not a good look.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the audience participation portion of our program. Step right up. Please tell us your name and ask your question.
Hi. My nona was named after Mafalda, which is a specific type of pasta.
That's so interesting.
Come on.
Oh, my God. Wait, why would they do that?
Was her name Mafalda?
Yes, her name was Mafalda. And I was wondering if you're going to venture into the pastina world of the Italian pasta.
Evan, what are your thoughts on those?
I love pastina so much. And when you find yourself in a store that has a large selection of pastina...
And wait, I'm sorry, just define that term, folks.
Pastina is little tiny pasta shapes, often used to introduce solid food to babies, and always served in broth. And...
it's like the little stars and the
little stars. It's where alphabet soup came from.
A while back, I picked up some Hanukkah-themed pasta shapes. They're like dreidels and Jewish stars, menorahs.
That's hilarious.
I got them at this. I don't know. Have you guys heard about this really super high-end Italian market? It's called Bed Bath & Beyond. Yeah. So I found the Beyond.
I love that.
And, my kids love the dreidels. But... they lacked in two-sick ability, I'll be honest. Okay, please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Bernadette, and my question is, very early on, Dan asked, what sauce is best with spaghetti? And I was surprised that neither of you mentioned cacio e pepe.
Oh, because I don't think of cacio e pepe with spaghetti.
No?
Mm-mm.
You think of it with?
Bucatini.
Ah. And that is fair.
It's just cheese and pepper, whatever.
No, seriously, I mean, it's in Rome, it's like more commonly served with bucatini.
But why is bucatini better than spaghetti for cacio e pepe, which is cheese and pepper?
So actually, I wanted to say something about this. When we talk about sauce here, we tend to think about like sauce, like something that was bubbling in a cauldron, when really sauce just means condiments. And so there are a lot of sauces... traditional Italian sauces that are just a group of ingredients that have very little adhesive quality until you actually put it in a pan with a little bit of pasta water and maybe some additional butter or some additional oil, and then you create the adhesion. So for me, something like cacio e pepe, which is relatively simple, it's like one ingredient or, you know, with water, it just cries out for bucatini because bucatini has the, like, the meatiness to deal with that cheese, which you would normally think of as being on a fresh pasta. I don't know. It's a rabbit hole. What can I tell you?
Would you say that the traditional Italian method of saucing pasta, which is, like you said, not to actually douse it in sauce, but to just kind of lightly coat the noodles, means that the whole argument for bucatini being filled with sauce is a little bit BS?
No, because...
Just a little bit?
No.
Not really that much sauce to go in the thing?
No, because actually the whole point, it's the right amount of sauce for the noodle you're using. And so the idea is that the process of saucing it, it should become one thing. Like, everybody's had the experience of having a bowl of spaghetti, twirling it, bring it to your mouth, and then the sauce just goes bloop into the bowl. That's not pasta. That's not pasta.
What? We got time for one more audience question.
Hello, my name is Allison, and I'm from Roosevelt Island. And I was wondering, I heard Evan speaking that every pasta shape has a pasta sauce. when you're cooking yourself a pasta dinner, do you decide the sauce first or the pasta shape?
I decide the dish. So it's a whole. They're not separate. It's something that is, it comes fully formed.
You fully see formed. It as a whole.
I see it as a whole, okay. Yeah.
Like the linguine vongole on the beach.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Ooh, yum.
Francis?
Most frankly, it starts with what vegetables I have.
Yeah, me too.
In the fridge. And like, I got to cook that tonight. And then it goes from there to how am I going to make it? Am I going to cook it soft? Am I going to cook it in oil? Am I going to cook it in butter? Am I going to roast it and just kind of eat it like along with a very simple condiment, like Evan said? Or do I want to cook it into a sauce? Do I want to take eggplant and cube it and cook it down until it's a puree and use that as a sauce? So it's not traditional cooking. It's just kind of like whatever I can do to whatever vegetables I have lying around.
Me too. Because I mean, I will do anything not to go to the grocery store. I mean, anything. Like, I will make my own pasta rather than go to the grocery store. So it's not like I have 4,000 shapes in my pantry, right? I have a few bags of two or three long shapes and a few bags of short shapes.
Well, we got to wrap it up. I want to thank you guys so much for joining me. Thank you all for coming out. Francis Lamb hosts the radio show and podcast, The Splendid Table, from American Public Media. Big hand for Francis Lamb. And all the way from California, Evan Kleiman hosts the radio show and podcast, Good Food, at LA's KCRW. Big hand for Evan Kleiman.
Those were definitely loud.
Thank you so much for coming out. Good night. Coming up next week on the show, I bake cookies with Jake Cohen, author of the cookbook Jew-ish. Get it? Like, kind of Jewish? Jake went from not caring at all about Judaism to encouraging people across the world to host Shabbat dinners. We'll talk about that journey, and we'll talk about the very specific food-related gifts Jake got from his future mother-in-law when he first started dating his husband. While you're waiting for that one, go listen to last week's episode. It's the story of my friend Amy Pearl and her sudden-onset meat allergy. Yes, it's true. That one's up now. Check it out. Thanks. This show is produced by me, along with senior producer
Emma Morgenstern
and producer
Andres O'Hara.
Our editor is
Tracy Samuelson.
The show is mixed by
Jared O'Connell.
Music help from Black Label Music. Special thanks to the folks at Caveat, as well as Anne Sani, Gofan and Putubuele, Francis Lamb, and Evan Kleiman. The Sporkful is a production of Stitcher. Our executive producers are Peter Clowney and Daisy Rosario. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And I'm Noni from New York City, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.
Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Did you know that the bold, smooth taste of Dunkin' cold coffee can be brewed in your Keurig coffee maker and enjoyed at home? Dunkin's cold K-Cup pods were crafted to be brewed hot and enjoyed cold. And of course, they're packed with the Dunkin' flavor you crave. Brew over ice and sip in seconds. Because the home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.